From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. I grew up with the phrase, sleep tight, don't let the bed bugs bite, but I never knew what a bed bug was. Sadly, after a 50-year absence in the U.S., they're back, infesting homes, hotel rooms, even staking out territory in some movie theaters and public transportation. On today's Fresh Air, we get some perspective on this new epidemic and some practical advice on how to prevent home invasions or, if it's too late, get rid of the bugs. Our guest is Michael Potter, a professor of urban entomology at the University of Kentucky. He's written extensively about bedbugs and co-authored a report on their resurgence. Also, we listened back to an interview with comedian Robert Schimmel, who died Saturday at age 60. He'd had lymphoma and two heart attacks and needed a liver transplant, but it was a car crash that killed him. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I don't know about you, but checking into hotels during my vacation had a new note of anxiety. Will there be bed bugs? I inspected. I lifted the sheet and looked at the edges of the mattress and, thankfully, didn't see anything. In spite of the fact that this wasn't exactly a thorough inspection, I got through my vacation bug-free. I'm really not sure how worried I should be about the spread of bed bugs and what precautionary actions to take. To get a sense of perspective, as well as some practical advice, we have as our guest today Michael Potter, who is a professor of urban entomology at the University of Kentucky, specializing in pests infesting buildings, people, and pets. He's the former technical director of a major pest control company. If you want to know what to look for, he describes bed bugs as the color of an apple seed and a little bit smaller. Typically, bed bugs can live 2 to 3 months without feeding, which is one of several reasons they're hard to get rid of. Michael Potter, welcome to Fresh Air. Give us a sense of how big the problem is. You co-authored a study, the University of Kentucky and the National Pest Management Association, surveying the U.S. and international member companies about the state of the bed bug resurgence. So what did you find?
Well, what we found was not really that surprising to us, that bed bugs are resurging throughout the world, not just here in the United States. So we're really dealing with a global resurgence and of growing importance worldwide, affecting many different types of stakeholders, not just homes and hotels and apartments.
But also,
well, where do we start? College dormitories.
Yeah.
College dormitories, homeless shelters, nursing homes, office buildings, hospitals, schools and daycares, movie theaters, modes of transportation, laundromats, retail stores, libraries, camps. Should I keep going?
No, maybe you should stop. So when you mention that whole list, is the typical clothing store infested? Is the typical library infested, or are these one-offs?
No, Terry. First of all, we need to, put a lot of this in perspective. What we're seeing with the bed bug is not surprising at all. If you look back at the historical precedents for this bug, it was quite common in places beyond where people slept. That said, we're still in, I think, the early stages of bed bugs showing up in these less conventional places like clothing stores and libraries and movie theaters. And we have to sort of keep a sense of perspective about ourselves about the likelihood of finding them in those types of places.
And you think it's pretty unlikely right now?
Well, the problem is building. It's just a matter of what you mean by unlikely. I would say that people should probably be unconcerned about encountering bed bugs in those types of places at this point. Is it possible? Certainly it's possible. But what's happening is the news media attention focusing on these isolated infestations here and there, I think, creates huge concern among people. And I think we have to keep a bit of this in some perspective.
So what are the cities with the biggest infestations now?
Well, there have been different surveys on that, and I think it parallels, basically the larger metropolitan areas that have a lot of people and a lot of movement of people tend to have more bedbug problems. So it's, of course, cities like New York and Philly and Detroit and Chicago and San Francisco, Baltimore. And there have been some lists that list those and others. But basically, when you've got lots of people living in close proximity to one another and lots of travel and movement of people, you're going to have bedbug issues.
And typically, it spreads from the cities to other locations, suburbs, and then beyond suburbs, yes?
Well, that's correct. I mean, the bug has a remarkable ability to move from one place to another. And again, we could go back to the 1700s and see exactly the same patterns where bedbugs originated in large seaport towns and areas of commerce. And with time, they moved inland with the railroad and so forth to more rural outlying areas. And we're seeing the same pattern again today. Places that didn't have bed bugs 5 years ago are now reporting incidents as well.
Why are they sometimes called the perfect parasite?
Well, I've used that term for a number of reasons. First of all, they bite you while you're sleeping, you know, under cover of darkness in your bedroom. The bites are painless. In other words, the victim seldom realizes they've been bitten until sometime later on. So there's a lot of confusion in terms of, you know, what's happening here. Unlike a lot of other parasites like ticks and fleas and lice, bed bugs don't stay on the host. They scurry away to their hidden harborages that are often far from obvious. And then on top of all that, people react to bed bug bites differently. Some people don't react at all. They're being bitten, but they just don't react. And in other people, the reactions are delayed until maybe days or even as much as weeks later. So it creates a lot of confusion in terms of what exactly is going on. So it's a very efficient critter from the standpoint of doing its business and creating a lot of anxiety and uncertainty in terms of what's happening.
If the bite is painless, is that because they basically anesthetize us when they bite us?
Yeah. When a bed bug bites a person, they inject both an anticoagulant, which allows the bug to extract blood from the human, and also sort of an anesthetizing agent, which causes the bite to be painless, unlike, say, a flea bite, for example. And, you know, if you just sort of use common sense, that's a good survival mechanism, because if, you know, you woke up and you felt the pain immediately, not too many bed bugs would survive to feed another day.
How does a bed bug bite compare to a mosquito bite?
Well, in people that are sensitive, they both cause these raised, red, itchy lesions. And, you know, everybody is different in terms of how they react to insect bites. Some people, you know, I get bit by a mosquito and I itch for 20 minutes and it goes away. You know, my wife gets bit by a mosquito and she itches for 2 weeks. People that suffer bed bug bites tell me that they itch like crazy. In other words, the itching is very intense, often lasting for an extended period of time. But in most people, you know, the reactions are somewhat similar in that you see these raised, red, very itchy welts.
So at the risk of stating the obvious, why do bed bugs live in beds and how do they manage to live there?
Well, one thing that a bed bug needs to survive is blood. So this creature has evolved over the eons to feed on humans. And from an efficiency standpoint, you know, much of in the insect world is about efficiency. Why crawl further than you have to for your next meal? So the bed is probably the most common place where bed bugs are found, although we do find them in couches and recliners, which also people tend to sleep in. But with time, they move outward from the bed into lots of other places. But the bed is certainly ground zero for bed bug infestations.
And apparently they like to live in cracks and folds. So that kind of crevice at the end of a mattress where the ticking, is that what it's called? That there's that raised thing at the edge of a mattress. They apparently love to live in that crevice there. So why do they like cracks and crevices and edges like that?
Well, a lot of insects like to be up against edges. If you were to put a bunch of bed bugs into a flat dish, they would work their way to the edge of the dish. If you were to put a pencil in the dish, they might line up along that pencil, much as they line up along those seams and folds and corners of mattresses. So those are the places we typically find them. But we have to remember that the mattress, basically when you find bed bugs on the mattress, you've probably got fairly large numbers of bed bugs because they tend to prefer even more secluded places like the juncture between the box spring and the mattress, the underside of the box spring where it sits on the frame of the bed. In the case of a hotel room, probably the first place you'll find bed bugs is behind the headboard because there's less disruption in that area, yet it's close to the person sleeping. So they've adapted and learned, you know, where are the most efficient places to be close to their meal and still be hidden away, which is, of course, is one of the most maddening things about, you know, bed bug eradication and detection is finding all these hidden locations.
Okay, you're killing me. I recently stayed at a couple of hotels, and I thought, okay, I know what I'm doing. I know about the bed bug thing, so I'm going to lift the sheet in a corner and look at the mattress. And I did that. I looked in one corner of the mattress, looked in another corner, and I thought, nothing there. We're done. I'm safe. And now I realize I had done nothing. my search was completely inefficient.
Well, you've done more than nothing, and at least that's a good start. You know, we have to be realistic about these things in terms of what people are going to be willing to do. And I mean, I can tell you what I do. You know, when I inspect my room, first thing I do before I unpack is I remove the bed sheets and the blankets. I'm probably going to be blackballed from every hotel in the United States after I've revealed this on air. And I examine the upper and lower seams of the mattress at the two corners by the pillow area and along the seam that runs below the headboard. The reason I look there first is that bed bugs tend to be drawn to heat and carbon dioxide as a person sleeps. So typically, if they're on the mattress, we're more likely to see them in that location. Now, we could see them at the foot of the bed, you know, or around the label or in other places, but I'm basically, you know, lazy like everybody, and there's only so much I'm going to do. So that's the first place I look, and if I can see the upper seam of the box spring in those areas, I'll take a look at that as well, looking for the little brown bugs themselves, as well as the black speckling little spots, which are the droppings of the bed bug. The fecal material of the bed bug.
My guest is Michael Potter. He is a professor of urban entomology at the University of Kentucky. We'll talk more about bed bugs after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're talking about bed bugs. My guest, Michael Potter, is an expert on that. He's a professor of urban entomology at the University of Kentucky and has actually worked in the pest control business as well. We were talking about what you do to check out a hotel room. Have you been in hotel rooms where you've checked it out and realized, yes, bed bugs?
Yes, I have.
So then what do you do?
Well, you know, everybody's entitled to do what they want, but what I do is I contact the front desk and say I need another room, preferably one that's, you know, farther away than the room next door. I should say that I've, you know, I do a more thorough inspection than what I just mentioned to you.
Oh, keep going. You know, keep going.
Well, I mean, when you get on the internet, you read about this stuff, and I think it's a great time to clarify some things. It is probable that if you have a very low-level infestation of bedbugs in that hotel room, you will not see them in the areas that I just mentioned. As I said, when pest control companies inspect hotel rooms or hotels inspect the rooms themselves, it's a prudent practice to remove the headboard if the headboard is fixed to the wall. In many hotels, the headboard rests on a little ledge that if you basically lift the headboard up and off, it will be removed. And we often will see these earliest stages of bed bug infestation behind the headboards, around the crevices and the seams where wood meets wood, the corners and so forth behind that. But, you know, these headboards can be very heavy, and it's probably an imprudent practice for the average person to try to remove these things. And it can be difficult to get them back on the wall afterwards. I take some other precautions. I tend to not spread my stuff all over the room. I tend to, you know, use what I need and zip up my suitcase. I tend to leave my suitcase on as hard a surface as I can find, like a tabletop or credenza, or if that's not available, on the luggage rack, rather than laying it on the floor, you know, or up against a wall, or in the corner of the room, or on the other bed if there happen to be two beds in the room. But this is just me. I mean, you know, you asked me if I've found bed bugs in hotel rooms. I have, but it's still a pretty rare occurrence. I think I've only found them two or three times, and I travel a fair amount.
So when you say, okay, there's bed, you call the front desk, you say, there's bed bugs in my room, I need another room. Why don't you say, there's bed bugs in the room, I need another hotel?
Well, for starters, you know, most bed bug infestations in hotels are spotty. In other words, they may have, you know, one, two, a few rooms that are infested. Rarely is the entire hotel infested. And I think that's a really important point for people to remember, because I think there's a perception that, you know, if you read something online that there were bed bugs in somebody's room, that means the whole hotel is infested and we've got to go find another place. That's usually not the way it works. Do we have some hotels that have, you know, more extensive bed bug problems? We do, but that tends to not be the case. So, you know, usually getting another room, and preferably one that's not right next door, because there is a tendency for bed bugs to move from room to room. So, in other words, the odds increase that they'll be in the room adjoining to the room that you find them in initially.
You're a pro. You've been studying bed bugs for years. You used to be in the pest management business. Are you as creeped out by bed bugs as most of us are?
Not creeped out, but very concerned. Very concerned, because I think we're in uncharted waters this time with bed bugs, and a lot has changed societally since we dealt with bed bugs, you know, 40 or 50 years ago.
What's changed?
Well, all sorts of things. I mean, we've got unprecedented movement of people today, and we know this bug has an amazing ability to hitchhike from one place to another. So while we didn't just start traveling, you know, 10 years ago, we certainly have a lot more movement of people today than years ago. I mean, the bed bugs that you're dealing with in, you know, an apartment building in New York City could have come from across the ocean, you know, 2 days before. There's a lot more stuff and clutter that people have today. In other words, you know, if you looked at a typical boarding house or dwelling in the 1930s, you know, they didn't have all the books and CDs and electronic equipment. And
you're describing my home.
and the relevance of that is that, you know, as bed bug problems persist, they tend to move outward from the bed into all the other stuff. So from a preparation standpoint, it's extremely draining on people to have to prepare their home or apartment for bed bug inspections and treatments, because they can be in all this stuff. And pest control companies are very apprehensive today about over-applying pesticides. You know, we've been training the pest control industry for over the last 20, 25 years, you know, don't spray where you don't need to. And heaven forbid, don't spray anybody's bedroom, because that's not where bugs typically live. And for goodness sakes, don't spray their bed. Well, these are, in fact, exactly the places where bed bugs live. So, you know, we generally do not spray over people's clothing and bed sheets and stuff on the floor. So it requires a lot of preparation. But there's a lot of other reasons why things are different this time around. We have, unfortunately, less potent insecticides for both the pest control professional as well as for use by householders themselves. What pretty much wiped the slate clean on these bugs was some phenomenally effective, long-lasting insecticides that we don't have available for use anymore today.
Because they're too toxic.
Well, there's some debate about all that, but basically, yeah, there are concerns about health risks with these materials is why they're no longer on the market.
You're talking, for instance, about DDT, right?
Well, DDT and some of the products that came after it. I think people need to understand that probably the single biggest reason by far that allowed us to virtually wipe the slate clean of bed bugs in the 1950s and 60s was the availability of DDT, which was just phenomenally effective on bed bugs and lasted a really long time, perhaps as much as years after the treatment. But maybe, you know, as bigger than all of those reasons, Terry, was that people have changed today. I mean, we have literally gone through, you know, a generation where we live pretty much vermin-free, at least in the developed world. And I think with that, we've developed sort of a sense of entitlement or a sense of, you know, that everything goes right and you just don't live with blood-sucking parasites feeding on you while you're sleeping. So I think people have gotten so creeped out about this, and there's a tendency today to, you know, frankly, you know, want to blame people when something goes wrong. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all evolves. And of course, the news media attention directed on this is something that also has changed quite a bit from years ago when people would, I'm not saying that bedbugs weren't a big problem and concern years ago, but it was another thing that life threw at you. Whereas today, I think, you know, you get two or three bedbugs in someone's cubicle in an office building and they vacate the whole office building for 3 days. You know, that, those sorts of changes are quite different this time around.
Michael Potter will talk more about bedbugs in the second half of the show. He's a professor of urban entomology at the University of Kentucky. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From Subaru, where all vehicles are built in zero landfill plants. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. And from Crown, publisher of Third World America, How Our Politicians Are Abandoning the Middle Class and Betraying the American Dream, by Arianna Huffington. This is NPR.
Coming up, advice on how to get rid of bedbugs as we continue our conversation with entomologist Michael Potter. Also, we remember comedian Robert Schimmel. He died in a car crash Saturday at the age of 60. We'll listen back to an interview we recorded in 2008 after the publication of his memoir, Cancer on $5 a Day, about his treatment for lymphoma. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about the resurgence of bedbugs in the U.S., what precautions to take, and if you have an infestation, how to get rid of the pests. My guest, Michael Potter, is a professor of urban entomology at the University of Kentucky and is the former technical director of a large pest control company. He's written extensively about bedbugs and co-authored a study about their resurgence. So if you find that you have some bedbugs at home, what should be the first step?
Well, first of all, you're either going to see the bugs or you're going to start developing, you know, these red, very itchy welts. And while that's not a guarantee that it's bed bugs, because there can be all sorts of things that can cause, you know, red, itchy welts, but if you suspect bed bugs, it would be prudent to contact a pest control company to come out and do an inspection and try and verify that, in fact, that's what is the problem.
And if it is the problem, what are some of the tools that the individual and the pest control company have to deal with the bugs?
Well, they start with an inspection to confirm, you know, that bed bugs are, in fact, the culprit. And then what they should do is provide the person with education, information, instructions about how to prepare for their treatment. And unfortunately, this is where, you know, a lot of the anguish and exasperation comes in, because typically pest control companies will require that people remove all of their belongings from floors. Many companies will ask them to strip the sheets off the bed and launder all of those bed linens. They'll ask them to empty closets, and commonly the drawers in the bedroom at least. So there's a tremendous amount of preparation, and then all that stuff either goes into the washing machine on a high-temperature setting, or you can just put it right into a clothes dryer, and the heat from the clothes dryer will accomplish the same thing. But then all that stuff gets bagged up or put into large, you know, Tupperware-type containers while the pest control company does their series of treatments. And that can take some time. So often people are living out of, you know, trash bags for several weeks or longer.
So if you're using a dryer, what heat does it need to be at to kill the bugs?
Well, basically, if you take a bed bug and you put them in a container and you heat that container, which could be your clothes dryer, up to, say, 120 degrees, those bugs will be dead in a matter of, you know, a few minutes or less. And most clothes dryers, if you take a thermometer, you know, an infrared thermometer, and shoot it into a clothes dryer while it's running, usually you're in that range of, you know, 120 to 160 degrees Fahrenheit, even at, you know, low to moderate settings. So a clothes dryer is your best friend in de-infesting items that either you choose not to wash or just can't be washed. So, you know, people are throwing out a lot of things unnecessarily, and basically, you know, clothing, kids' toys, backpacks, sneakers, you know, a lot of that stuff can go into a clothes dryer and be de-infested quite efficiently.
Heat treatments are effective if you're throwing your clothes in a dryer. Are there other forms of heat treatments, like for your mattress or for the bed frame, that could be effective?
There are. Some pest control companies around the country are offering total heat treatments where they literally heat up an entire home or an apartment or in a hotel room by either bringing in large heaters into the dwelling or running flexible ducts from the outside of the building and pumping heat into the building, hot air. The idea of this is to elevate the temperatures wherever the bed bugs may be hiding to at least a temperature of about 120, 130 degrees, which kills all the life stages. It can be very effective. It can be very efficient. In other words, rather than battle these infestations for many days or weeks or perhaps months, we can often eliminate the infestation, you know, that day. But the technology is rather costly. It's not unusual to spend in excess of $1,000 or more for a heat treatment, and is not really that widely available throughout the United States. The equipment is quite costly, so only a relatively small percentage of pest control companies around the nation are currently offering heat treatments. And the other thing is the heat technology doesn't have any residual lasting effect. So if it's an apartment building, for example, you could de-infest you know, an individual unit of its bed bugs, but if bed bugs are reintroduced into the building, you could have the problem again.
And I imagine if you have like art on the walls or a vinyl record collection, that the heat would not be good for that.
Well, there's a short list of things that have to come out of the building, things like medications and chocolates,
right,
and bottles of wine that might burst. But surprisingly, most things can stay. Computer equipment, electronics can stay, for example. They monitor the temperatures that the heat gets up to ensure that they don't get to those levels that can cause damage to most household items. So usually you're not heating the unit to much more than about 140 degrees, which seems high to us, but in fact, most items won't be damaged at those temperatures.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about bed bugs. My guest, Michael Potter, is a professor of urban entomology at the University of Kentucky. He's not only studied bed bugs, he's the former technical director of the world's largest pest control company. New York recently passed a law that if you're renting in an apartment building, your landlord has to tell you of any infestation that occurred in the building within the past year. I'm wondering, like, if one apartment has had bed bugs in an apartment building, how likely is it that that will become a building-wide infestation?
Well, it's certainly a possibility, and like all legislation, there's often good elements and some elements that, you know, are a bit questionable. I think that everyone would agree that, you know, people should be entitled to know about things that can potentially cause them harm, particularly if, you know, the probabilities of that are quite high. So, you know, it certainly seems prudent, at least to me, that if a person is moving into an apartment that previously had a bed bug problem, you know, particularly recently, that they should be told that. I think, you know, there's a lot of questions out there, particularly among property managers, you know, what the prudence is of knowing whether there had ever been a bed bug problem anywhere in the entire building, because, you know, you could have a unit that had a bed bug problem on the 18th floor, and you're moving into a unit that's far removed from that, and maybe the infestation had been long since eliminated. So your risks are actually quite low in that case, but it certainly can create a lot of apprehensions in people. I expect what's going to happen is in cities like New York City, as people, tenants tend to realize that bed bugs are, you know, an increasingly common phenomena, that they'll perhaps sort of take this in stride, and that won't be, you know, the decision that determines whether or not they move into that building. But it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, because I know that there are a lot of concerns among property managers.
In one of the publications, and I think it was a publication for professional pest control people, you had an article surveying bed bugs, and there was an ad in the magazine that said, "Bed bugs are back, and so are your profits. Create a new revenue stream with the most effective bed bug trap and monitor available." So is this like a payday for exterminators?
Well, it's certainly true that bed bugs have increased the revenues of many pest control companies around the United States, particularly in the larger metropolitan areas. That said, I work with pest control companies all over the country and in other countries, and many of them have told me that, you know, they hate bed bugs. In other words, they love bed bugs because it generates revenue for them, but it is such a maddeningly difficult problem to deal with, and it causes a lot of aggravation for pest control companies as well.
So bed bugs are a real nuisance. They bite you. The bites itch. Do they carry any diseases?
Based on what's known at this point, the answer is no. The main problems with bed bugs appear to be the itching, the irritation. And of course, anytime you have a breakage of the skin from a bite or a wound, you run the risk of secondary infection. But beyond that, the biggest problem is the mental anguish they cause, the stress, the anxiety, the sleeplessness, and of course the financial burden of dealing with them. But at least at this point, we don't have the evidence to say that they transmit any diseases.
So in one of your articles about the history of bed bugs, you wrote that they basically date back to the beginning of humankind, and that there's like ancient fossils of bed bugs. What about that little rhyme, "Sleep tight, don't let the bed bugs bite"? Where does that date back to? Do you know, like, what era that's from?
Well, probably from the 1600s or so. In other words, that term had to do with years ago, our beds.
Sleep tight, that term?
Yes, often had ropes on the bed, and the ropes were essentially like a box spring today. They provided support as the person slept. So there was a little wooden dowel that you would tighten or twist that would tighten the individual cords of rope that would allow the sleeping surface to be firmer, so thus sleep tight, and then don't let the bed bugs bite, I assume. That was because they were, you know, common back then. But that's where the sleep tight came from.
Got it. Okay. Well, Michael Potter, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Michael Potter is a professor of urban entomology at the University of Kentucky. To find detailed instructions on how to make sure your hotel room is free of bed bugs, visit our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, we listen back to an interview with comedian Robert Schimmel. He died Friday of injuries sustained in a car crash. This is Fresh Air. Comedian Robert Schimmel, who was known for his self-deprecating, sexually explicit stand-up act and for his frequent appearances on Howard Stern's radio show, died last Friday after injuries he sustained in a car accident. His son and his daughter, who was driving, survived the crash. Robert Schimmel was 60 years old. Schimmel's comedy was dark and raunchy and often based on the minutiae of everyday life, but he also talked about life-changing events, like losing a son to leukemia and marrying and divorcing his first wife three times. Cancer became part of his stand-up act after he was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. The illness killed his sitcom deal and then threatened to kill him. At the time of his death, he still had serious health issues and was waiting for a liver transplant. I spoke with Schimmel in 2008 after he had been in remission for 7 years and had written a memoir called Cancer on $5 a Day, How Humor Got Me Through the Toughest Journey of My Life. Robert Schimmel, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm guessing it's easier to find the laughs in cancer several years after going into remission?
I found it right away as soon as the day I got diagnosed. I was in the oncologist's office with my parents and my wife, and he said, there's Hodgkin's disease and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and you have non-Hodgkin's. And I said, you know, that's just my luck. I got the one that's not named after the guy. And he laughed, and he said, you're going to be okay. And I said, how do you know? And he said, because your attitude is just, you know, you're who you are, and you're finding humor in it, you know. And he said, and that's a healthy thing.
So when you were diagnosed, one of the things the doctor told you was that during chemotherapy, it might really help to smoke marijuana.
Yes.
Were you already into smoking pot? Was this good news? You
know, well,
the doctor was telling you, hey, you know.
Well, I had done it earlier in my life, but I was 50 years old and not Rodney Dangerfield. So I wasn't doing it then, but my mother and father were there in the doctor's office, and when he said, if you're open-minded, you might consider marijuana because it helps with the nausea and the appetite, and it definitely does. I mean, I tried Marinol, which is medicinal marijuana. It's synthetic THC, which is pills that they give you, and because the flip side of that is getting Compazine and Zofran shots and all these things that are a lot worse and more toxic than marijuana would be. But to hear a doctor at Mayo Clinic tell me that it's okay to smoke pot in front of my parents was almost worth the diagnosis. Because, you know, it was like, wow, where were you 25 years ago? That's when I really needed you. And my mom called me once and said, I'm coming to visit. Is there anything I could bring you? And I said, could you stop at the 7-Eleven and get me some rolling papers? And my mom's 70 years old, Hungarian. She was in Auschwitz during the war. And she calls me from the 7-Eleven and goes, Bob, they have like 20 different kinds. I don't know which one to get. I said, there's a white pack with a guy on the front. And she said, the anti-Semitic looking guy. And I said, the zigzag guy is anti-Semitic? And she came over and You know, I thought it would be really cool to be smoking a joint in front of my parents. It wasn't what I thought it was going to be. I realized that they were accepting it because of my condition, and it wouldn't have been that way if I had not been sick. And so anything I did like that confirmed to them that I was in pain or feeling nauseous. And I had to sneak it because I had children, and I had a 9-year-old daughter. And I don't want to be a father that says, do what I say and don't do what I do. And I made a pipe out of a piece of a cardboard tube from a coat hanger. And I fell asleep, and my daughter found it. And when I woke up, she asked me what it was. And I told her I was trying to make like a kind of a whistle or a flute. And she didn't say anything to me. When I was done with chemotherapy, I had a record deal with Warner Brothers, and they gave me tickets to see John Fogerty, who was performing live in Phoenix. And I took her on a date with me to see John Fogerty. And as soon as we walked into the place, she said, "Hey, Dad, it smells like your whistle in here." And I knew I was busted right then, and that she was just playing dumb when she found it.
You know, of course, with the chemo, you lost your hair, which you expected, but you probably hadn't been thinking so much about losing your pubic hair, which, of course, you lost, too. And you made an interesting discovery, which other people who've had cancer might already know, which is they have wigs for your pubic hair, to replace
yes.
your pubic hair. They even have a name. What are they called?
It's called a Merkin. It's Merkin. They've been around, actually, since the late 1800s. You know, the guy showed me a ring binder with headshots of wigs, real wigs. And, you know, I was losing my hair anyway before chemotherapy. And so just jokingly, I said to the guy, "You got one for, you know, south of the border?" And the guy said, "As a matter of fact, we do." And I was shocked. And he was showing me pictures of them. And they basically, it looked like a donut that somebody dropped on a barbershop floor. And they had different models. There wasn't just one. There's like the executive, the adventurer, salt and pepper, the surfer. And it was really the craziest thing that I ever bought in my life. And
you bought it?
Of course I did.
As a
you
prop?
Know, guys are,
as a prop or to actually
no.
wear? Wait, which?
I
which?
Was pretty insecure. You really
you really wore it.
Yes, I tried it. You know, I looked at myself naked, and, you know, a 50-year-old man that's bald down there, it's not really a good look. It looked like a small plucked bird fell in my lap and broke its neck during the fall. And guys are insecure enough about, you know, size and everything else, so when you don't have hair down there, it didn't work with me.
We're listening back to a 2008 interview with comedian Robert Schimmel. He died Friday of injuries sustained in a car crash. We'll hear more of that interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering comic Robert Schimmel, who died Friday of injuries sustained in a car accident. We're listening back to an interview we recorded in 2008 after the publication of his memoir about being treated for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. He had been in remission for 7 years when we spoke. During the period that you had cancer, you tried a bunch of alternative therapies and relaxation techniques. Which of all of those seemed most out of character for you?
The crystals. My wife took me to this place and got crystals and, you know, told me that my chakra was off or I don't know what that, you know. At that point, you're trying anything. And so I had a purple crystal that I was supposed to put between my eyes on my forehead and lay there and then hold a different stone in one hand and one on my belly button and one on the other hand and meditate. And at the same time, I was getting reflexology and acupuncture and Reiki and meditating. So I don't know which worked, which didn't work. But as far as far out, probably the crystals. The other things were, I could tell the effect immediately. I could feel it. And if it was my imagination, as long as, to me, it was working, that's all that really made any difference.
Well, I completely understand. There's one point where you're describing one of the alternative therapies, and you say, and you describe how much of the musician Yanni you'd be listening to, and I'm thinking, oh no, Yanni. And then you say, if I beat this thing, it's because the cancer cells couldn't stand Yanni anymore.
Yeah, yeah. That the cancer cells are like, you know what, we've had enough of this, let's get out of here. And you know what, I wound up meeting John Tesh, and I told him that.
Oh no.
And I didn't know that, like, him and Yanni are like rivals, you know, because they both play
New
Age
music. Oh yeah,
because
John Tesh had that whole New Age thing going on.
Yeah. And so he thought it was hysterical that I was making fun of Yanni's music like that, and because they're very competitive with each other. He told me that they play volleyball together and that Yanni's like really hell-bent on beating John Tesh constantly.
Who knew?
They don't seem like that type.
No. When you were told that the chemo had done its job and you were, for a short or long term, going to be in remission, you didn't know yet if it was going to be long term or not, and you felt that gratitude, was there somebody you had to thank? I mean, your doctors, of course, your family, of course, but, like, did you have a, like, religion? Did you have, like, a God to thank, or was it?
Yes. I think I'm more spiritual than actually hardcore religious. But I prayed to everybody, and I didn't discount the fact that maybe Jesus is the one, maybe Buddha is the one, and I prayed to everybody and promised to celebrate everything when I got out. But the other people that I have to thank, besides who were with me and God, are the people that are in clinical trials that volunteer for that. And, you know, if you're in a clinical trial for a new cancer drug and there are 1,000 people in the trial, 500 people really get the drug and the other 500 get a placebo. It's not that you don't get anything. You get what's standard treatment for that, for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but you don't get the extra thing that they're testing. They never tell you whether you got it or you didn't. You never know if you did. You're a number. You're not even a name on those tests. And there are people that volunteer for that, and their whole mindset is, I might not make it, but maybe they'll learn something with me, and that'll help somebody else in the future. Well, I'm getting to have this conversation with you right now because I was in somebody else's future. So every morning when I wake up, I thank people that I can't even connect a name or a face to.
You describe in your acknowledgments, you know, one of the people you thank is Howard Stern, who called you in the hospital. But part of the reason why he called you, apparently, is that he had a death pool on the air.
So
was he betting you were going to die before New Year's? Was that it?
They were placing odds. It's something that they used to do every year. And so he called me, and I was live, and I had no idea. And I was in Mayo Clinic, and he said, how you doing?
So he's calling you live on the radio?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So, and he goes, how you doing? And I said, you know, I'm pretty sick. And he said, you think you're going to make it to New Year's Eve? And I said, why? And he said, because Robin has Anthony Quinn picked, and I have, it's between you and Anthony Quinn. And I said, pick Anthony Quinn, because I'm still going to be here. And then Anthony Quinn died, like, out of nowhere, and I felt really bad. I mean, he wasn't even sick, Anthony Quinn. So they just picked that name out of nowhere, and it wound up happening.
So when Howard Stern called you live in the hospital because they had a death pool, and they wanted to know if you were going to make it to to New Year's, did that seem funny to you at the time?
Yeah, because I know Howard, and the first time I met him, I hadn't listened to his show a lot, and Warner Brothers got me on there because that's what I had my record deal with. And when I sat down on the couch, the first thing Howard said is, you lost the son, didn't you? And there was no pre-interview. I mean, and he just wings it. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh, God, I mean, what am I supposed to say? And he said that must have been, you know, really tough to go through something like that and still be a comedian. And I told him that the Make-A-Wish Foundation came to our house and they wanted to make a wish come true for my son. And I told them that his wish was to watch me have sex with Dolly Parton. And the Make-A-Wish people were pretty stunned. And Derek, though, thought it was funny. My son almost fell out of his bed. And the lady, you know, I told this on the air, and Howard was screaming, and he said, you know what, you could be on for the rest of your life, because I actually had a comeback to something like that, and it wasn't something negative. And that's the way I choose to look at it. You know, I can be miserable. I mean, I have the ultimate trump card. I lost a child. I can fail at anything and use him for an excuse. And instead, it forces me to do the opposite. And I will not exploit what he went through to elicit any kind of response from an audience. I will talk about him if I'm doing a charity event for cancer. Otherwise, he's not really a part of my stand-up act.
Well, Robert Schimmel, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. Really appreciate it a lot. And, you know, be well and good luck. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Robert Schimmel, recorded in 2008. He died Friday of injuries sustained in a car accident. He was 60. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Saab, for people who have a different perspective on driving. Learn more at SaabUSA.com. Saab, move your mind. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
Jonathan Franzen's new novel, Freedom, landed him on the cover of Time magazine last month. In the Sunday New York Times Book Review, Sam Tannenhaus wrote, "Franzen's new novel, like his previous one, The Corrections, is a masterpiece of American fiction." On the next Fresh Air, Jonathan Franzen reads from and talks about freedom. Join us for the next Fresh Air.